Hi, everybody. I'm Robert H., and I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God and because the 12 steps of alcoholics actually work, I haven't had a drink since March 13th, 1990. And for that, I'm just incredibly grateful. My home group is the Back to Basics group in Ballantyne, South Carolina. If y'all are ever down that way and headed toward Lake Murray, please come visit. If we could open with a moment of silence, thinking about just the gratitude of everybody over the past 75 years that has been able to find our fellowship and recover. Thank you. And with that, I'm just incredibly pleased and honored to introduce our three speakers this morning. We have Aaron with us from Delaware, Terry from Arizona, and Renee from Oklahoma. And I'll begin with Aaron.
Good morning. My name's Aaron, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's a real honor to be here. You know, when I came to AA, no one in AA ever lied to me when it came to AA. And, you know, one of my old-time friends said, you know, if you go back out, it'll get worse. And then another one of my old-time friends told me when I first came in, you know, you'll be rocketed into a fourth dimension beyond your wildest dreams. And last night, I was rocketed into a fourth dimension beyond my wildest dreams. This is my first international. You know, I had hesitations about coming here. You know, I put a letter in, you know, asking if I'd like to speak, thinking I'd never get called. And I got that letter, and I didn't have airfare. And then within a matter of days, everything worked out. That airfare's dropped, you know, and here I am. And, you know, I had two chances of going to AA. And the first one, I came in and tried to do it my way. And, you know, and I went back out, and it got worse. And just like that gentleman said it would. And I was out there for 4 years, and, you know, I went through hell, you know. I was married and put my wife through hell, and it got worse. And I finally came back into AA with the willingness, you know, saying I was going to do anything. But, you know, at the time, I was helpless and hopeless, and I didn't think this program would work for me. You know, it worked for all you guys. And then this little old man from Philadelphia came and spoke to me, and he gave me hope, you know, because he was a guy that lived on the streets of Philadelphia for 25 years. He was a bum, and I figured maybe if it worked for him, it might work for me. And he says, you know, give it a try, Aaron. If it don't work, they'll refund your misery. And I was in misery, you know. I was in pain. Nothing inflicted the pain upon me like alcohol. I was shot, stabbed, beat up numerous times on the streets of Philadelphia. But the pain I felt from alcohol, that was the worst. And I'm sure you, most people here would agree. And but I didn't think this program would work for me. I really didn't. And then that man gave me hope. And, you know, I went to meet the next day, and he was there, and he remembered my name. And I never forgot that, how these, you know, old-timers or the people that were here before me could remember your name, because I'm not good at names. And so I came to AA, and, you know, when I was out there, I was God. You know, I thought the world revolved around me, and then alcohol became my God or my higher power. And every major decision, you know, I made in my life after I picked up a drink was made from alcohol. You know, I went into the service because my life was a mess, thinking I'd get direction from going in the military, thinking they didn't drink in there. That's how much brains I had, you know. And, you know, it got worse. Then I come out of the military. I says, well, that didn't work. Maybe I'll get married, you know. That'll fix my life. So I got married to a woman that had two little kids. And, you know, I drank more because the more responsibility I had, the more I needed to booze. And it got worse. It got a lot worse, you know. And by that time, I drank indoors, you know. And you know, my life just went totally downhill. And you know, and I come from a very religious family. My parents never drank. And I used to go to church and pray that this pain would go away, that I could get my life straightened out. and it didn't work, you know. And then, you know, I figured, you know, my God turned his back on me, you know. And but today I know that he was there all the time. And as things got worse, you know, it just, I hated myself. I hated myself. And it just was bad. You know, I mean, things just got worse. So I finally come to AA, and, you know, you put down a drink, and then Aaron shows up, you know. And you figure, who the heck's this guy Aaron, you know? I'm living with these people I don't even know, and what do I do now, you know? I don't know what to do. But, you know, the people in these rooms, the ones that were here when I got here, you know, they loved me when I couldn't love myself because I didn't know what love was. You know, they took me by the hand, basically, and showed me, you know, what to do. And most of the things, you know, I didn't want to do. You know, I didn't know how to do. You know, like when I got a sponsor, you know, that was the hardest thing to do, was trust somebody, because I didn't even trust myself. How could I trust somebody else? I get a sponsor. He tells me to call him. I hated phones. Every time the phone rang in my house, I was in trouble. So I call this guy up. I call my sponsor up. I says, this is Aaron. I'm calling you up. Click, you know. And I did that until I could talk to people, because I didn't know how to talk to people. And that's, you know, this is like it came. This is when I started, you know, believing things, you know, by doing the things I couldn't do. You know, I didn't know how to do, by doing the things I didn't want to do. And the hardest thing for me to do after that was, you know, when at 90 days I had to speak, because where I come from, you know, you're not allowed to speak. You know, the 89th day told me, you're speaking tomorrow. You know, I got a commitment lined up, and I was scared to death. I couldn't sleep at night. You know, all the things like crazy I did in my life, I was more scared at that moment doing something to save my life. But you know what? I did it. I didn't like doing it, but I did it. And then that's when I realized that there was someone there helping me along. You know, I wasn't alone anymore. I had all you people, you know, in my whole drinking days, even when I was married, I always felt alone. But now I felt I wasn't alone. And that was a big milestone for me, because that was something I didn't know how to talk to people unless I was drunk. You know, I'd go to family functions, and there are people standing around, sitting around for 5 hours, not drinking, talking. I said, how do these people do this? I mean, it was so foreign to me. And here I am doing it now. And, you know, it was, you know, it was amazing, because I didn't think I had it in me. And then things just progressed from them, going to, you know, doing service commitments and detoxes and prisons and stuff. You know, I never thought I could do that. But, you know, all we have is our experience, strength, and hope. And that's how we help people. And it took me a long time to understand that. You know, I'm just another drunk that couldn't stop drinking. But by telling people how I stopped and how I did it might help them. And you never know when you're going to help someone. You know, I found that out. You never know what little thing you might say that will really turn that light bulb on and really make a difference to someone. And it's an amazing thing. And my, you know, sobriety got better and better by the more I got involved and doing the things I didn't want to do, you know. And today, I still think I'm going to wake up one day and I'll be back in that hell, you know. I can't believe my life today. And, you know, I have a higher power today because, you know, he's up here with me. I didn't think I could ever do this. And here I am, you know. It's such an honor, you know. And, you know, I owe it all to you people. You know, I don't deserve any credit for doing what I'm doing, because you people taught me how to be this person I am today. I'm a father, I'm a husband, and that's something I never thought would happen, you know. I mean, I was one, but, you know, I was there, but I wasn't there. I was never present. Today I'm present, you know, and good and bad, but, you know, I'm present. And it means a lot. I mean, it means a lot to them, and it means a lot to me, because I'm a human being today, and, you know, I owe it all to this program and, you know, my higher power and you guys, you know, because you taught me how to be a human again and a person, and you taught me love. And I want to thank you, and that's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you, Aaron. And now we hear from Terry.
Hi, I'm Terry. I'm an alcoholic. Wow. sorry. I'm in control here, so if you don't mind, thank you very much. My sobriety date is January 20th, 1991. Thank you. And I'm your plan B. Actually, someone else was supposed to speak today, but she called me yesterday afternoon and said she wasn't able to get a flight out of Phoenix, and could I stand up? And I'm like, whoop, okay. So when I looked at the topic, came to believe, I immediately thought of step two. You know, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I had already accepted that I was powerless over alcohol, and I knew that that first drink was what got me drunk. But I didn't really think about the insanity. I didn't think I was insane. You know, don't most people poop in parking lots and wake up in strange places with strange faces? And as somebody in one of my home groups likes to say, lose their panties, you know? I thought everybody lived like this. And, you know, my perception of an alcoholic was a bum living in a cardboard box, drinking out of a paper bag, and that was not me. I had a house, I had a car, I had a job, I had suits, you know, so I wasn't an alcoholic. But I knew I had this drinking problem, and I started talking about the drinking problem. But came to believe, for me, was a process of hearing it enough times, getting it in my head, and eventually having it move to my heart. And it wasn't a conscious process. It just happened that way, because you people kept telling me, keep coming back. So I got sober in New York, if you can't tell, because I used to have coffee and talk. And I did what they say, you know, don't do. I moved when I was about 10 months sober to Michigan. And that was like moving to a whole nother planet. But what I found there was a group of loving AA people. And when I first came to AA, I did not believe in God. I didn't like God. So I used a group of drunks, good orderly direction. I used really the people in the group as my higher power, because here was a bunch of people that were happy. You know, when you first walk into your first AA meeting, you're like, oh God, this really sucks. But I realized that these people knew something that I didn't know. They knew how to live life one day at a time without drinking. They knew how to do their laundry without drinking, how to go food shopping without drinking. That was amazing to me. So when I moved to Michigan, I still didn't particularly care for God, but I landed with a group of people who were kind of big book thumpers. And I remember about 2 years sober, driving around with a friend of mine, and I really started to think about, okay, I'll call him God, but how do I love God? I don't know how to do that. You know, do I send cards? Do I send flowers? I don't know how to do that. And he said, Terry, in order to love God, you have to love the things that God loves. You have to love all of God's children. And I'm like, even the assholes? And he's like, especially the assholes. You know, and when they told me to pray for somebody, should I pray for a heart attack or a car accident? No, Terry. Keep coming back. And just to give you a little background, in New York, my whole world was, you live in New York, you retire to Florida. There was barely life past Pennsylvania, but people lived in California. Sorry, Texas. Sorry. That was my little world. So when I first moved to Michigan, I was like, Michigan? And I was there for 18 months and started to become human. When a recruiter called me and said, hey, do you want to move to Chicago? Got a great job, all that stuff. Because I moved to Michigan for a job. So I moved to Chicago, you know, bitching and moaning, wah, I got to start all over again, new sponsor, all that stuff. And I ended up meeting a wonderful, wonderful man, my husband, who we've been married now for 15 years. He's a gift in my life. Because, you know, as well as coming to believe about the insanity, I've come to believe so many other wonderful things. And he has helped me come to believe Rule 62. Don't take yourself so seriously. He has helped me laugh, which is, I think, one of the best gifts that you can give someone else. So we got married in Chicago, and then I got another job offer, and we moved to Arizona. And by then, I started, you know, I came to believe that, hey, you know what? This whole deal might not have anything to do with a job. You know, because moving to Michigan had to do with becoming human and losing some of that New York anger. Moving to Chicago had to do with meeting George and the people I met there. So now I'm moving to Arizona thinking, oh, you know, what's it going to be about now? What am I going to learn now? And the neat thing was, it had nothing to do with me. It had everything to do with George getting involved in the community. So, you know, all of a sudden, I came to believe that, oh, you know what, maybe not everything has to do with you. And for some of us, that could be a very rude awakening. and we had, you know, so at this point, I'm like, okay, Arizona's fabulous. They're going to take me out in a coffin. But God had other plans. You know how God gets these plans. So I ended up losing my job, which I kind of knew that God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. And we moved to South Carolina. And South Carolina, I came to believe how insidious my disease and my insanity really was. Because, you know, the Big Book talks about alcohol is but a symptom. So I'll give you an example. I don't know if any of you guys have done this, but I can talk about stuff that I know nothing about and be the expert, you know? So my husband had gone to culinary school. He's a chef. He knows stuff. Meanwhile, you know, I work 10, 14 hours a day. If it takes more than 5 minutes in a microwave, I'm not interested. So we're going to have some people over for dinner. And I didn't even go food shopping for several years after we got married. I didn't see the inside of a supermarket. So anyway, we're shopping because we're going to have some people over for dinner. And he starts loading green beans into a plastic bag. And of course, I know how many green beans we have to have. And I look at him and I say, that's enough. And he gives me this look, like this dull stare, and just keeps reaching into the beans and putting them in the bag. And he asks me so nicely, are you the bean police? Like, where do I come off trying to control freaking green beans? But that's my insanity. That's the insanity of my disease. That I, you know, stuff that I know nothing about. So I came to believe that my insanity really is deep-rooted. we stayed in South Carolina, had a fabulous life there. Again, met some lovely, lovely people. And I came to believe that, you know what, no matter where you go, if there's an AA meeting, I can be there. I've had to become a newcomer all over again many times. But God and you people have really taught me how to do that. You know, how to get phone numbers, how to get a new sponsor, how to make women friends, go to women's meetings, all that stuff. So, of course, you know, God has a whole nother plan going on. And I came to believe that I got fired from my job, which, once again, I knew I didn't belong there anymore. It's amazing to me how at one moment you absolutely are right where you're supposed to be, and 3 years later, you don't belong anymore, and you wonder, what happened? Plans change. Get a job offer in Arizona. So here we come, back to Arizona. And I came to believe that the more I stay sober 24 hours at a time, the less I know. You know, and over the last year and a half, I've really been getting into the big book. And I don't know if this has ever happened to you guys, but you know how you read something for the umpteenth time and all of a sudden it's like, that wasn't there before. Who put that in there when I wasn't looking? So, you know, reading the black and white and seeing how simple the language really is has just been an incredible revelation to me. You know, it talks about when we overcome the spiritual malady, the mental and the physical will be taken care of. So other than worrying about all this stuff like green beans and everything else, like this morning I was worried about the line at Starbucks. I don't have to worry about that shit. What a relief. You know, all I have to worry about is my conscious contact with my higher power and trying to be of service and doing God's will. And everything else falls into place. You know what? That's really not that hard. I complicate it so much. And I love what Aaron said about, I was so afraid of doing something that would save my life. That's a keeper. I mean, that is just so true. Is that insanity or what? So what you people told me about, you know, I came to believe God and the spiritual program and the goodness of all these people, the love in these rooms, went from la, 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 like somebody was talking about in one of the meetings, you know, Snoopy, where the parents are talking, wah, 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 kind of started to rattle around in my head and finally got into my heart. And I've accepted things down to the very core of my being. That's the faith. That's coming to believe for me. And I could not have done that. You know, it talks also in the big book that we were reborn. Absolutely. I mean, there's a definite time when that door shut on my previous life and a new door opened. And, you know, you people also told me when one door closes, another door opens. And I have come to believe that if I'm stuck in the hall, it's time to start wallpapering because God will open that door sooner or later. You know, other than that, I hope if you're new, you keep coming back. And when I looked at the stadium last night, I was just in awe of how many miracles and how many lives have been saved. Just the people in that stadium. That is God. And today I believe in God. I try to love all of God's children. I try not to control things. Progress, not perfection. God bless you all. Thanks.
And now we hear from Renee.
Hi, everybody. I'm Renee Bayes. I'm an alcoholic. And I've been sober since January 15th, 1988. And for that time, I'm really grateful. I have a little cough. I hope I don't cough. I recently started smoking again. And I love it. I'm home. I'm sorry, I shouldn't smoke, I know. And many of you have told me, out on the sidewalk, that's really bad for you. You shouldn't do that. I'm like, well, you shouldn't talk right now. People you don't know who really need to smoke. So I hope I'm not hacking and coughing, but a little tickle came up. So grateful to be here. This is such an honor and a privilege. It's so nice to be asked. Thank you, Rick and Jill, for the invitation. I, too, cannot believe it. Like Aaron, just wow. This will be a memory to treasure for a lifetime. And I love you guys, and I thank you for my life. My sponsor's here. I love her very much. I told her she could go hear her sponsor who's speaking at the same time. I said, no, really, go. No, really. Really, you can go. You don't have to hear me. I want you to go. Really. It's like, no, I'm coming to hear you. And I shut up. You know, when your sponsor gets that tone, you learn to just, okay, we'll do it your way. It's easier. And I love you, but you are louder than my head. You're very loud. She doesn't look loud. She looks so sweet and soft. But I love her very much. She's a wonderful person, Sharon. I'll just start off by saying that I don't really... I came from a mother who was a drunk but also schizophrenic. And my father tried to keep the family together. And so recently, my older sister, who could be one of us, and she'll tell you, she could be one of us. She'll tell you, she loves us. She loves our meetings. She loves everything about us. She loves the fellowship. It's just a whole not drinking thing that she doesn't like. Otherwise, she'd be with us. And I tell her, that's called a bar, but you do your thing. I love her, but she's been trying to dig up information from our past, which I'm not interested in, you know. My past is my past. I'm totally over it, or so I thought. And a couple weeks ago, she has been emailing an aunt of ours that I have no contact with, and they've been talking about our past when we were children and emailing each other back and forth, and she decided to save all these emails and send them to me. Hi, Lynn. And so this one email, my aunt was describing coming to visit us when we lived in San Diego. My older sister was in the first grade, and my older brother was in the fourth. She said, well, you and your older brother got yourselves dressed, you made yourselves breakfast, and you went to school. Got yourselves out the door and went to school. And your father had a big blackboard, and he put everything on it that Marianne, your mother, was supposed to do for the day. But what she would do is she would shut her door. And Renee, me, was 4 years old at the time, and she looked so lost. She would sit outside the door all day. And that was a memory I did not want. And 2 weeks ago, my older sister emailed me this and said, you might want to know this, because she's still there. She's still living in the pain that we lived in. And I am not. However, it brought me back there very quickly. And I remember sitting outside my mother's door, and I remember saying little prayers to get me through the day. And I remember asking God to have Mom open the door. And that was the beginning of my lack of faith in God. That was the beginning of my anger toward God. My mother left home, and I prayed that she would come back, but she had to leave. She had to go. She was an alcoholic, but she was also a very bad schizophrenic. And today I know that when I was locked out of her bedroom, she was keeping me safe from her. And when she left home, though, she was still my mom, and I wanted her back. And I remember praying, because my dad took us to church. We went to a Mormon religion church. And I remember praying that my family could get back together. Nothing happened. Things just got worse. So by the time that I was a young adult, you know I had a bad attitude. You know I didn't care about anybody, and you know I found drugs and alcohol. And, you know, I couldn't drink every day, but I did drugs every day because they're easier, you know, for young adults to get. And I was just a miserable kid. And, you know, by the time I got to you guys, I was hanging out with thieves and prostitutes. Don't ask me how I got there. I don't know. It's all a big misunderstanding. Long story after long story. I was really mostly just hanging out with the thieves because I didn't like women. But, you know, you spot it, you got it. And I was living in Anaheim in California, Southern California. And it's just been a long, rocky road. I'd been beating myself up. I'd been getting beaten up. I've spent years on the road with a magazine sales crew, and I had boyfriends that weren't good for me. And, you know, on a good day, I would get to stay at the Hyatt down the street from Disneyland. And on a bad day, I was staying at the Peter Pan Motor Lodge. And on a really bad day, I was staying someplace else. And I threw myself away. I threw myself away. I had no contact with my family. I had no contact with my father. My father was a very good, decent, kind man. He did not know what to do with me. I remember before I left home when I was 17 and I was gone. Absolutely. Before I left home, I remember him looking at me going, "What is wrong with you?" He tried everything he knew to help me. Everything. Including when I got out of high school early, he sent me to a little Mormon junior college, and that did not work out well. You know, because I'm sure there was other kids there like me, and I found all three of them. I managed to get in trouble there, but they kicked me out of that college before I was 17, and my father looked at me and said, "What is wrong with you?" And I looked up at him and said, "What is wrong with you? I don't get your life. I don't get what you do. You have never done anything, well, you know, anything fun," I thought. He put himself through military school. He was a Navy pilot. He was a professional pilot and, you know, was raising a family, remarried somebody, and they had more kids. And he was just trying to get along in his life. He didn't understand alcoholism. He came from it. It's in our family tree, but he didn't understand it. And he was doing his very best to control the situation, control the fires, control the kids, control Renee. If I can just get Renee under control, that'll be one less fire, you know. And I could not be controlled. I couldn't be contained. I was a wildfire. And, you know, so when I had no contact with my father and I ended up like I did all those years later, you know, I had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous just for sort of like a joke. If I wanted to bum cigarettes, you know, I knew where to go. If I wanted a place to stay, if I wanted to sleep on somebody's couch, I knew where to go. I was very young and pretty, and I knew how to work it. Honestly, I worked it. You know, I could work it today, but I'm too old for that. I'm not a cougar, trust me, I'm not. I don't even think of myself that way. You know, it's kind of silly to go there. Last night on the elevator in the dome, I thought we were going to our doom, all these people walking together. It was scary for me. When I got on the elevator and there's a little old guy in a wheelchair, he said, "You want to sit on my lap?" I said, "No. I'll ride with you." That was a wrong thing to say. I said, "To the fifth floor." Anyway, so where was I? I'm totally gone. Now I'm wanting a cigarette. My husband says hello. He can't believe that I'm here, and he loves you very much for asking me, so thank you. I had a hard time coming in because I'd been in and out of AA so many times before that I just thought it was so cliche, and I couldn't feel anything for anybody but myself. And I couldn't cry for anybody anytime unless it was me. You know, your stories meant nothing to me. The lost dogs in the street meant nothing to me. Little children crying, who cares? You know, but when I thought about me and I could put a drunk on and drink in my motel room for days. And then I would just get out and do it all over again, you know. I wasn't much of a motel drinker. I would start in the motel room and then I would just have to leave. You know how it is. You got to see what's going on out in the street. You got to go make that turn, get out on the street and go see what's happening. And so by the time I got to you, I just didn't think a spiritual way of life would work for me. And, we would pray in the meetings, and I kind of missed praying in this meeting. I did. We would open up our meetings with prayer, and that's how we do it in my home group. I come from the Phoenix group in Norman, Oklahoma, and I'd like to thank the girls that came to support me. Thank you very much, and I love you. It all meant nothing to me, and I really had a hard time, just like Aaron said, it had a hard time believing that this could actually work for me and believing that you had anything to offer somebody like me. But I listened to your stories, and I kept coming back. And eventually, you know, I ended up in a halfway house in Dana Point, California. And someone there had told me that I should at least try to pray. I should try to pray on my knees. And I did it. I tried to pray on my knees. And I felt better when I got up. And, I keep coming to believe. It's not came to believe for me now. It's I keep coming to believe because I don't still get along with people really well. And I have a hard time in this life. I compare and complain and don't feel good enough and full of fear. And it's hard to walk around with all of that going on up here all the time, as you guys know. But when I listen to you share your stories, the language of the heart, I understand you. I get exactly where you're coming from. And this fellowship is so beautiful. I was watching a policeman out on the sidewalk, and he had a big smile on his face. He had the biggest... He was cute. Not as cute as my husband, but he was cute. He's very cute. He was really cute. Men in a uniform, I'm telling you, there's something about a man in charge. It's awesome. But he was smiling. He was smiling and he was directing us. And I think they really love having us here. At least he looked like he did. And, you know, what a difference to go from where we were to come together as a group of drunks with good orderly direction to make an impact like that, at least on that one cop, you know? Maybe when he picks someone up tonight, he can say, AA really works. And you might want to drop him off at a meeting. I don't know. You know? They never really did that for me. They said, what's the matter with you? You sit right there. Don't move. Yes, we are putting cuffs on you this time. anyway. I don't know. I think, have I gone too long? Because it seems like I've been up here a long time. Okay. So, yeah, it came to believe for me... I am very self-righteous, just like Step 2 talks about, and it's an ego-feeding proposition for me, just like Step 2 talks about. I love to be judgmental, and I love to think that everyone else is doing it wrong, just because I love to feed my own pride and ego that way. And for a long time, I was very self-righteous about Christians in general, not just my father and his church, but Christians in general. And so it took me 10 years to be able to write my father a letter asking for his forgiveness because I really didn't think that I needed him to forgive me for anything. 10 years of sobriety, and I was thinking, I didn't hurt my father in any way. You know, I wasn't, clearly, I wasn't thinking with a right mind, and I wasn't thinking sanely about it. Looking at the big picture now, being able to swallow some big chunks of truth about myself, I can see I totally broke his heart. You know, when you don't know where your kid is, I have 2 children now and I miss them. And when you don't know where your kid is, for all those years, you know, I called a few times for money and my dad was smart enough to not send it. And I was on my own. And I thought when I went to the mental hospital, this is how it's going to be. And I went to the mental hospital a few times. And when they have you in restraints, and you're sitting there with just yourself and your thoughts and you're waiting on your medication, something dies inside you and you say, this is how it's going to be. I watched my mother be in restraints. I watched my mother be in mental hospitals. And I just thought, this is how it's going to be. I have my mother's illness. I didn't know anything about schizophrenia. And I don't have schizophrenia, not most of the time. No, I don't have schizophrenia. I actually am going to college now, and one of my first papers was on schizophrenia. My second one was on drug abuse. My third one was on alcoholism. And my teacher was like, wow, you should get into psychology. So that's what I'm going for. We'll see. I don't know if I'll make it, but I don't know. I would resign myself in the mental hospitals. This is just how it's going to be. And I have a whole new way of life today. I did not know that the problem centered in my brain. I couldn't tell you that I was judgmental and self-righteous. Hell no. I was self-righteous in a badass way. And I'm sorry, I cursed, but she did first. We're in like a cement building. Surely we can say, you know, I won't though. I'm sorry, Sharon. Okay, now I totally lost track of that. But being self-righteous, yeah, that's me. I'm self-righteous and it gets in the way. And when someone told me at a convention, we were talking about my father, and he said, "Have you ever made amends to your dad?" And I said, "I don't feel like I have anything to make amends for." He said, "Well, you know, you caused a lot of harm there, and how do you think that made your dad feel?" And I said, "It's that whole religion thing. My dad would be a good person if he didn't go to church." And he said, "That is your dad's fellowship. This is your fellowship. That's your father's fellowship. You know, your father's never drank. He's never done any of that. And here you are leading this life the way that you are." And a light went on inside my head. That is his fellowship, and it's okay. Can I love him for who he is? My heart was such a hard little ball. I couldn't even love my own father. I'm sorry, but I couldn't. I had no love for him. I had no love for my family. And in AA, my heart's been broken a few times. And what my sponsor has told me is, that's okay. Because when your heart breaks and it mends back, it grows back a little bigger. And your heart's going to break again. That's all right. It'll grow back bigger. And so I put myself out there. I say yes when I'm asked to do things. It's scary, but I know that, you know, this is another growth opportunity. I don't want to be the same old me. I don't want to be the person that's full of myself who has to fight with everybody, you know, in sobriety even. There was a lady a few weeks ago after I got that letter, didn't want to sell me a lighter in a convenience store because I'd already bought my cigarettes. I was on edge. And she ran my credit card through, and she didn't want to run my credit card through for 98 cents. And I mean, I did, it was on, and the look in her eye, it looked like she was telling me, "Why don't I dare you to take that lighter and just leave?" That's what I saw. Looking back on it, I think she was going, "Why are you so crazy? Why are you such a crazy white woman? Why don't you just leave my store and leave me alone?" So, you know, what happened was I was able to make a better choice because of you guys and because of what I've learned from my lovely sponsor. I was able to rise above it in an instant. I turn around and there's a couple of homeless guys behind me. We do have homeless people in Norman. Not very many, but they're there. And, you know, you kind of get to know who they are. You know, that's the guy that rides the bike. That's the guy that wears the thing on his head. That's, you know, the lady that carries the same sack, the same Walmart sack for years. So there's a couple of them behind me. And I was like, "Can you believe this?" I turn around, "Can you believe she's doing that? She's not going to sell me a lighter." And I realized, wow, what if they come to the meeting tonight? And I'm in here. I'm like spreading all this gross stuff around, just being mean, you know. She was being a bee back. But anyway, when I realized that they may be showing up at the meeting tonight, I was stopped, Sharon. I stopped and I rose above it. And I said, "You know what? Ha ha ha. It doesn't matter. My husband's shop is right down the road. I'll just get a lighter from him. That's fine. You have a nice day." And I walked out, and she goes, "You have my pen." I said, "You know what? That's just about right. I do. I have your pen. Ha, ha, ha. Here's your pen. La, la, la. Have a good day." God bless you, everybody. I'm in AA in case you want to come to a meeting tonight. I didn't say that, but you never know. You just never know. You know, if we're a link in the chain, you know, there's people watching us. There are. I've got 22 years of sobriety. So what if I want to kill myself at 20? So what? That's over with. And people are watching me. There's newcomers who watch me. They watch how I talk. They watch what job I have. They watch how many meetings I go to. This isn't just about me anymore. This isn't just about my comfort. This isn't just about well, I don't know, I think I'll go to this meeting and not that meeting, and I've been there and done that. I'm going to keep being here, and I'm going to keep doing this because you all saved my life. And now this little bitty heart that was so hard has come to believe in the power of God. I pray all the time. I have come to believe in the power of God and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous to save our lives. So my kids, I have two kids now, and they have a mommy that they depend on. And I love them so much. And I know I could drink again. I've smoked again. If you would have asked me 3 years ago, I was one of the self-righteous ones going, I'll never smoke again. I feel sorry for people that have to smoke. And I got a little caught up in self, and I was going to school and working full time, and you know, something had to give. I know I could drink again. I know I could. And I'm a bad drunk, and I don't want to go back there, and I don't want any of my friends to go back there. But if my kids ever need this program, I want it to be strong. I hope the doors are open like they were for me. I hope the coffee's made. I hope that there's committed meetings and the meetings start on time. And the international is big and beautiful and bright, and the policemen are smiling as they're walking us across the street. I hope it's just the same for them, only bigger, brighter, and better, because we're all here doing the work. I love you. Thank you so much.
Rick Walker promised me that I could share a little bit if there was time, and I think we have some time. And I got to tell y'all, how many here are here for their very first international? Just right. All right. I would like to share with you a little bit about my experience with coming to believe. Before I do that, though, I got to qualify myself a little bit and tell you a little bit about my powerlessness. I don't remember my first drink, but I remember my first drunk. I'm 13 years old. I get my hands on a half pint of Smirnoff Red Label vodka, and I walk to school, and I drink it. And now I'm mad because nothing happened. Until I get into third period English class and throw up all over the back of the classroom. Now, just those few lines, you've got me pegged, okay? Because I drank by myself, drank all I had. All I had was so much that it made me throw up. And there's the kicker. I threw up, I wanted more. Now, earlier on, I had got my hands on some spoiled chocolate milk and made me sick enough to throw up. Hadn't had chocolate milk since. But I knew as soon as I threw up and that feeling hit me, that magic hit me, I knew that alcohol was going to play a part in my life, a big part. And bad things started happening pretty quickly. I was passing out by the time I was 14, 15. I was blacking out by the time I was 17, 18, and that was a whole new realm of terror. I mean, at least when you pass out, when you come to, you're normally in the same clothes. When you black out and come to, you may or may not be in the same clothes. You may or may not be in any clothes at all. But I'm sitting there. I actually got my first DUI at age 18. And I had to explain that to my family. And this ties directly into my coming to believe, is that my explanation went, it's just unlucky. You know, I was just truly unlucky that first DUI. But you see, my father was killed by a drunk driver when I was 9 years old. And my mom couldn't understand how in the world I would put somebody else's family members at risk like that. But I explained to her it wasn't going to be a problem because it was never going to happen again. I got my second DUI at age 20. And I got to share just a little bit about this because it tells you the transformation in my life that I will end with after having come to believe. I'm 20 years old. I'm bar hopping. I'm on the bypass in a very rural town in South Carolina. And I look up and I see the state trooper behind me. And I immediately look down and I'm going 40 in a 45-mile-hour zone. But I ain't afraid of him. So I speed up to 45. Show him I'm not afraid of him. Now I'm watching. I'm watching him, I'm watching the speedometer, I'm watching him, and I miss the red light in front of me. Well, I go ahead and pull on off because I know he's going to chat with me about this thing. And to this day, I think I got myself talked out of it, and he starts searching my car. Now, that very day, I had found out I had been accepted to the University of South Carolina School of Law. And I knew he couldn't search my car. I knew he couldn't search my car. He just didn't know I knew he couldn't search my car. So I told him. I said, excuse me, you can't search my car without my consent unless I'm under arrest. Well, after he put me under arrest, I went down and blew a 10 on the breathalyzer. And at the time, that was the limit in South Carolina. I heard a comedian say, I think he's from Texas, this comedian, say that he knew he had the right to remain silent, just the inability to do so. And that was me. I blow a 10, but I know my rights. So I demand a blood test. Blood comes back 18. I am convicted of my second DUI, having walked away showing them who they were dealing with. That arrogance lasted me through law school, out of law school into treatment, out of treatment into a homeless shelter, and trying to work through that. And I was never broken until it got to the point with suicide attempt, just the other knowledge that I was hopeless and helpless. It got so bad at one point that my mother forged my name to a life insurance policy to make sure she had enough money to bury me. And I had an employer, they sent me to outpatient treatment. I went to talk to a counselor, and my first words out of my mouth to this guy was, you got to do something special for me. I got to do something super duper for me. Alcoholics Anonymous won't work for me. And he said, Robert, that's your problem. The question has never been whether or not Alcoholics Anonymous would work for you. The question's always been whether or not you're willing to work for it. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, well, have you actually tried working the steps? And I said, no. So now here's my experience with step two. When I got here, y'all would sugarcoat this thing. It used to drive me nuts. I'd sit in meetings and y'all talk about higher power this, higher power that. And I knew you were talking about God. And I figured if God was involved with this thing, I will drink and die. Thank you very much. Because you see, God and I cut a deal pretty early on. I'll leave you alone if you leave me alone. And I kept drinking. And this counselor explained to me that really the only thing I needed to do with between step two with this coming to believe is to believe in something greater than me. And that the first part of the 12th step talks about having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And that maybe I would find somewhere between what I needed somewhere between step two and 12. So I said, okay. And I started doing that, and I had these revelations, just these mini revelations, actually working the steps. Sit in meetings talking about the fourth step, thinking I was doing the fourth step by talking about it. But by actually working the program, doing the step, I realized that God did not kill my father. It was a 17-year-old girl who had too much to drink that night that killed my father. And all those times that I drank and drove, if I would have hurt somebody, that would have been on me. Wouldn't have been on God. So why couldn't I give him the same break? And that opened the door. That was the key to that lock of me coming to believe in something greater than me. Now just a little bit of this transformation I wanted to talk to you about in my experience of coming to believe. And the best way I know how to do this is just give you little snapshots in time, little before and after shots. After my dad died, my mom remarried, and she married a Southern Baptist preacher. Now, everybody that had bad thoughts when I said Southern Baptist preacher, this guy was a poster child for that. I tell you, man, he was a piece of work. And I wanted to tell him that, but I couldn't tell him that drinking because he just dismissed me as a drunk. So I figured I would get about a year sober, and then I'd tell him what I thought of him. And he up and died at 9 months. Mad. I'm sitting down there. I'm at the funeral just mad. I'm just seething. I mean, after all that old man did, he wouldn't even give me the courtesy to live long enough for me to tell him off. And I caused my mother pain. This was the second husband she had lost, and I caused her pain. My mother remarried again. I promise you, she's not killing these families. She's just outliving them. But my mom remarried again, and he died too. Except he died in a hospital room surrounded by family and friends in a room full of love. With me holding his hand. And I don't know how you get from where I was to where I was without the transforming power of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, without coming to believe in something greater than you and undergoing that transformation. Now, my mother's still an interesting lady. Back about the time she forged my name to a life insurance policy, I was calling her needing money. I had to have money. Got to have money. Nobody would take my check anymore. Go figure. And I brought her to tears. And she told me, do you want me to just go ahead and die so you can get all of it now? And I remember telling her, no, I don't want that to happen. But I remember thinking, if that's what it's going to take, it wouldn't be that bad. My mom had a stroke about a year and a half ago. She's in an assisted living facility now, and she calls me her office manager because I take care of all her finances. We were in a CVS pharmacy here a while back, and she picked up some knickknacks and stuff, and the bill came to about $20, and she only had about 10 or 15, so I went ahead and paid for it. Didn't think much about it till we got back to her place. And she leans in and she goes, you know you can take that money out of my account. And I don't know how you get from there to there without the transforming power of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife and I just moved to Newberry, South Carolina, here about a year and a half ago. And I had the community choir leader ask me to be part of the Easter program. I said, I don't think so. But she asked me again. I said, okay, well, what do you want me to do? She said, I think you'd make a great Judas. I said, I don't think so. She said, well, go ahead and just read and see what all is involved. And I do. And come to find out, Judas has some of the best lines. Stuff like, it's not my fault. I'm thinking, I might be able to pull this off. So I get in there and I'm doing this and it's actually going pretty well. Amazed everybody, amazed me. And my wife asked me, did you know you could do this? And I'm going, no, I didn't. And she said, well, how are you doing? I said, I just remember a time when nothing was ever my fault. Because I learned pretty early on, you don't have to accept responsibility for the consequences of your actions. You can always blame somebody else. And when you run out of people to blame, you can blame God. Even a God you don't believe in. And she turned to me and she said, I can't believe you were ever dishonest. Now, at that point, we had been married 11, 12 years. And it dawned on me, I had never been dishonest to her. Now, how did that happen? I can't explain it. I can just describe it. And I don't know how you get from there to there without the transforming power of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. One last quick story and we'll close. When I drank myself into the homeless shelter, there were only three kind of people in the world. Okay, there were people that could hurt me, there were people that could help me, and there were people I didn't care that much about one way or the other. If you couldn't hurt me or help me, I didn't care for you. You weren't on my radar screen. My goal in life was to take the people that could hurt me, make them into people that could help me, and then use you up. Because that's what I did with folks. Today, through Alcoholics Anonymous and service in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know people all over North America. I'm sitting here at an international convention in San Antonio. Look at you all. I was sitting there commenting earlier, we clean up well. I got to look to see the little blue and the yellow that tells who's who. And I don't know how you get from a homeless shelter in Columbia, South Carolina, to the International Convention in San Antonio without the transforming power of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and coming to believe in something greater than us. So I thank you for giving me my life. And how about this panel of speakers?